City Talk 105.9, behind the scenes of the Hillsborough investigation.
City Talk 105.9, I'm Lauren Moss. This week, City Talk's been given an exclusive insight of the headquarters of the criminal investigation into the Hillsborough disaster. Operation Resolve, headed up by Assistant Commissioner John Stoddart, has a team of 170 people. They're going through hundreds of thousands of documents, many of which were uncovered by the Hillsborough Independent Panel, and many more which are still emerging. Working alongside, but separately to the police watchdog, the IPCC, the investigation is supplying material for the new inquests, which will begin in March next year, as well as conducting its own inquiry into the actions of the police, the FA and match officials at Sheffield Wednesday on that day in 1989. In a City Talk special over the next hour, you will hear a tour of Renaissance House in Warrington, how the Operation Resolve team came together and how they work, and the effect it's having on the officers involved as they work on what's emerging to be the biggest cover-up of all time.
Behind the scenes of the Hillsborough investigation, City Talk 105.9.
We're here in Warrington today at Renaissance House, the headquarters of the investigation into the Hillsborough disaster. And I'm joined now by Assistant Chief Constable Terry Sweeney, who's a deputy lead in the criminal investigation into what happened before and during that day in 1989.
Hi, good afternoon.
We're here today at this tremendously big building in Warrington. You have a lot of staff here. We're going to have a tour through the building. You're going to tell me what's what and who's doing what roles as part of the criminal investigation with Operation Resolve. But first of all, how did you come to be involved, and what is indeed your involvement?
I'm the lead working with John Stoddart on the investigation. The reason why I got involved with Operation Resolve, it's now called, or the investigation into the Hillsborough tragedy, is that my background working in Greater Manchester, I was the chief officer responsible for crime operations and subsequently for specialist operations that include the management of major events such as the Olympic period in Greater Manchester, major sporting events at Old Trafford and other football grounds around the area, and the holding of events such as the homecoming in Manchester, the major events as the concerts at Heaton Park for Oasis and that type of thing. So having that background, myself and John, who has been the lead nationally for homicide for the past 10 years, we've got a pretty rounded overview of this type of operation on the day itself, and understanding how it should have been run, and also how to investigate the terrible events that took place after that.
When was it you became involved?
I became involved in February this year, invited by John to undertake the role as his deputy in setting up the operation. And what we've been taking time to do is get ourselves into this building at Renaissance House in Warrington with colleagues from the IPCC, and building the investigative team up to 170 staff we now have working with us, who have got the responsibility for the criminal investigation into the unlawful killing of the 96 deceased from Hillsborough. And also responsibility to work to the coroner for the inquest process that's going to take place next year. And it's really important that listeners understand that it takes us back to the late 70s, to the certification of Hillsborough as a stadium to hold events such as the semi-final, all the way through to the death of the last of the 96 deceased, Tony Blund, who died some time after the event itself.
You have a team of 170 people just working on Operation Resolve. I mean, this doesn't even cover the IPCC investigation, which we'll touch on a little bit later. Yes. How do you go about assigning that staff, hiring them? Who do you look for?
Well, we look for people who've got a real depth of investigative experience in undertaking major investigation, and that includes homicide investigations that have been long running of great national sensitivity. So we've got colleagues who've been involved in many of the very, very highest profile murder investigations. Our senior investigating officer, Neil Malkin, has been involved in the investigation and review of the Wheating investigation into phone hacking in London, for example. Been involved in homicide investigations involving similar public events where tragedies took place, and involved in reviewing a whole series of major investigations. So we look for the very best across the country, and we've recruited colleagues from 14 forces nationally and national agencies to undertake this investigation. But the start point is they must be of the absolute highest calibre in terms of the professionalism and understanding of major investigation. And then what we look at are specific and discrete skill sets to undertake key roles. And it's such as, for example, working with the families and family liaison is a key element of any murder investigation, going back to the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, for example. And so we've gone to collect and develop teams who have got those skills, and then together we create that much larger organisation that's necessary to deliver this investigation from start to finish, in both the criminal context and also in the inquest, so that we got that capability within the team. Clearly, we need also to work with experts, because some of your listeners might say, well, what do the police know about the building of a stadium, for example? And they'd be absolutely right to ask that question. What do they know about the movement of fans in and out of a stadium? So in those cases, we've also recruited and engaged with colleagues from the health and safety laboratories, and we have an embedded health and safety inspector working with us as part of the investigation team. We've employed crowd dynamics experts to understand what the crowd looked like on the day and the risk that that posed by the numbers who were involved. And we're involving ourselves closely with colleagues who can help from a CCTV review point of view, and forensic specialists who will review all the medical evidence that's taking place. So building on that expert knowledge, delivering an investigative capacity and capability, we should have the resources required to deliver what's needed in terms of meeting the inquest timelines of Lord Justice Goldring, but then developing at the same time a criminal case to take in front of the courts in due course.
Thank you very much. We're right to have a look around now. When you come into the building here at Renaissance House, you go through the big electronic gates and very tight security there, and then you come into the main entrance and you're up in a foyer, which takes you through to where the two separate strands of Operation Resolve are. And we're walking through the foyer now. And where are we heading, Terry?
We're going to head towards the major incident room. And the building itself, just to be further to understand, is we have our major incident room and investigative teams on the ground floor. Ourselves and colleagues from the IPCC both work to and access the Hillsborough archive and store on the first floor, because both investigations need to access that area. It contains all the key documents and exhibits from the previous investigations. Major incident room in any inquiry is very much the engine and the heartbeat of the investigation. It's the place where we have to apply the rigour and the professionalism to build a case that can stand scrutiny and prove beyond reasonable doubt in a criminal case, and to meet the investigative standards for an inquest in other cases. And so it really is almost a production line in some cases, and it almost mechanises the process. And when you look at the room as we look at it now, at the very far end, we've got two banks of staff working in computers. The overall footprint in this area is around 54 staff. Overall, I say we've got 170 staff working with us. And it's important to start off really with the people who receive material. And this, at the far end, are what we call the reader receivers. And what they do literally is they review every document, every piece of evidence that's available to us, and assess it from opportunities for lines of inquiry. And they've been tasked by the senior investigating officers who are on the right-hand side of the room to look at the main lines of inquiry, i.e. the safety of the stadium, the movements of the deceased during the times we're there, and subsequently the emergency response that took place and the planning that took place for the event. So what these staff do is they'll assess that information as it comes in, they'll task other officers from it, and they'll make sure that any opportunities, any gaps in evidence can be filled by further work to be undertaken.
Where do they get the information from that's coming in?
They get the information from in our case, because it is a historic inquiry in some respects, from the archive, from working through the documents that are being validated there, and that means proofreading from the very original accounts that were taken and written rough notes through the statements, some of which have been altered and amended, and some of that work has been worked in partnership with the IPCC. They're assessing those, they're assessing exhibits that came from digital inquiries, so we've got a lot of work from there. We're assessing material from statements we've already taken, interviews we've undertaken, site work we've undertaken, pathology opportunities from post-mortem notes. So there's a whole plethora of sources and material.
Tens of thousands of documents.
Literally. I mean, we started off with almost 400,000 documents. At the moment, we've generated 28,000 items for assessment for disclosure of the new inquiry. That's not 28,000 pages, because each item can contain a number of documents and pages within it. Each of those items have to be properly assessed, and that's what they do. They review them, look for further opportunities, look for cross-referencing opportunities, because the rigour of a major investigation is that it can go into every detail, whether it's by statement, by individual, by contact, by other association, and we'll go through each and explore each of those issues, because we don't have to just prove a case, we have to also ensure that other people that weren't responsible for that offence taking place. Materials read and assessed, it's then indexed against any other material that's on the system. If it's new material, it'll be typed onto the system, and then these staff here will look at either the issue of it's an exhibit or how to disclose it in subsequent proceedings. On the other side of the room, we've got staff who look at the actions that are out already, and we've got hundreds of actions in play already. We've got an analyst cell who will prepare material for court, so they'll prepare charts and detail for court of movements of individuals, of how people were connected, how they made their way to the event itself. And we have an intelligence team who are looking at tracing witnesses, because there are many witnesses to be spoken to from a whole range of organisations. For example, on the day itself, from the Merseyside Police as spectators, there were over 50 officers in the crowd who are potential witnesses to us, who we can pursue and actually get further statements from. And finally, we have our interview advisors and assessors over on the right-hand side, who were looking at the planning and production of key interviews as we work forward through the investigation. And finally, we have a CCTV assessment unit on the other side of the room here. It all comes together to create this engine that gets the inquiries working, and that what they then do is send tasks out to our investigations team to get more evidence to feed the machine to actually produce that court presentation that's the complete story of what actually took place on the day.
So effectively, you're conducting the investigation as if it were 1989, indeed, but also modernising it and translating it for a modern audience.
Absolutely. That's really key, because what we can do is we can bring the investigative techniques we've got in 2013 to that context, very much as you rightly say, of the 1989 picture, really. So things we can do, obviously, advances in forensic pathology, advances in science around crowds, advances in the use of CCTV technology that we have now for major inquiries, just weren't available in 1989. Now we're looking at inquiries around financial investigation, but it was a science that really wasn't developed in the 1980s, but it's very much advanced now. So we understand the journey from the FA setting the fixture up with Sheffield Wednesday Football Club in March 1989 and understand the chain of events.
And at the bottom of the room as well, you've got some photographs of the victims, of those that lost their lives that day. I mean, how important is it as well that they remain at the forefront of everybody's minds too?
The key bit about the inquiry is that this is an inquiry into the loss of 96 lives on that day. And what you'll see around this side and the other side of the building, we constantly remind our staff of what they're here for. So the use of images is really important. And when we did our induction for all our staff, we play a presentation that takes them through individual by individual, because it's important that we don't just see the 96 as a collective, which of course they are, but they're actually 96 individual loved ones.
And it's bright and airy, and you can see that the trees outside, the sun's coming through at the minute. But I mean, what sort of hours would people work here? General office hours? Or
we tend to work from about 7 in the morning through to about 7 or 8 in the evening, and teams will vary over the time. And because, for example, we've got staff that we have this week over in Yorkshire interviewing retired police officers and people who are there on the day from St John's Ambulance, for example, they'll be working a later day because people will be available to them in the evening time. The staff who will be, for example, the typing and support work will often come in early to get work done and process material later on. So the offices tend to be open about 12, 13 hours both days. But if you need to work longer, we do. And if we need to position staff outside, we also do that, into Sheffield or into London, if we had staff down at the inquest last week. So it's quite a long working routine, but it's not unusual for major inquiries to work those hours.
Right, should we head through to the other room?
Sure.
Now? Still to come on City Talk 105.9, we continue exploring the headquarters of Operation Resolve, speak to family liaison officers and the leading police officer on the case.
Behind the scenes of the Hillsborough investigation, City Talk 105.9.
It's a City Talk special this afternoon. I'm Lauren Moss. Earlier this week, I was given a tour of the headquarters of the criminal investigation into the Hillsborough disaster at Renaissance House in Warrington. Working alongside the IPCC and Lord Justice Goldring, Operation Resolve is examining the actions of match officials, the FA and the police. Later, we will hear from the leading officer, Assistant Commissioner John Stoddart. But first, Assistant Constable Terry Sweeney resumes our tour.
Heading back through the foyer now, and the IPCC investigation, which is a separate strand, although obviously you are cooperating with each other,
yes,
is based upstairs in this building.
Yeah, we're co-located. It really helps to have the documents and evidence available to both of us from the previous inquiries. It makes it significantly easier for us to access that information and to share our assessments, because what we try to minimise is our teams going out interviewing witnesses and the IPCC team going separately. It's nice if we can go together and try and grab the information on a single visit, really.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm being co-located, helps with the coordination.
It's very tight security. Every door you go through, you need to
tap
in or enter in a key code.
It's important that it's secure and it's very much locked down. This is the investigation area. Similarly, a large open plan office to the one on the other side. But in here we have, whereas the major incident room is very much the engine and the heartbeat of the investigation, that's what we're describing. My physical analogy is the kind of arms and legs of the inquiry. These people go out and undertake the inquiries, do the interviews, do statements, and a set-up in the room around the main coronial investigative priorities of safety of the stadium, the emergency response, and the movement of the deceased. And we've got on the left-hand side, if we look at it over here, we've got the family liaison team and the admin support team in the corner. It's key that every investigation only works and it's got that support in place. So we start off at the top, the safety of the stadium. That strand is about going back to 1977, 78, and the safety certificate of the stadium, how it was amended, how it moved forward, and reviewing for the coronial priorities key events such as the 81 semi-final, the gap between the 81 semi-final and 87 semi-final, and the 88 semi-final before the day itself. And all the initial investigative assessments have gone into the coronial team on time. I know they wanted to interview members of the different organisations involved. So I have members of Sheffield Wednesday Football Club, the City Council, St John's Ambulance, the Ambulance Service, planning and preparation for the events, any major incident plans that were in place, were they tested and exercised, and how did they actually operate on the day, or did they not operate on the day, is the questions we'll be asking. And the movements of the deceased. They're looking at each individual loved one who died on the day and understanding what happened to them from the time they left home in Liverpool, particularly if they did, because the majority did, to the terrible outcome when they ended up in a mortuary and the family to identify them.
How much input would the families have then into the investigation?
They're really critical to us, and we've tried to work with that contact both at an organisation like the HFSG or HJC level and also on a personal level. So we have both the groups coming into the inquiry to look around as we're doing today, and also individual families to come in and look around the place as well. And we really welcome that, because it's important that they understand we're working for them, and we're here to answer their questions, really, because for 24 years they've had these questions in their heads, maybe, and they've not had a chance to answer them in terms of the previous processes there to live through didn't give them that opportunity. So it's important for us to actually try and establish that relationship with them and answer some of the questions that's been in their minds for so very long, really.
Given the fact of the extent of what we're seeing emerging of a cover-up and statements being changing and possibly video footage, CCTV emerging from the day as well, how important is it that the investigation stays as transparent as possible to the families so they know it's being conducted
properly? It's absolutely critical, because at the end of the day, this is an Article 2 investigation that will feed into an Article 2 inquest process, and a key obligation on us as an inquiry is to update those families. And also to be transparent to public scrutiny, and both obligations we take exceptionally seriously. So we have to be transparent. They have to have the opportunity to walk through the floor and to talk to people as you can today, so that they actually see what we're doing. When people like myself or John Stoddart gave interviews, people or talk at meetings, they can actually get behind us and say, well, you said that, let me see it in reality. And that's, it's touching the reality that's so important for people to actually confirm
we are doing what we say we are. We are carrying out the investigation with the rigour that we need to make get the outcomes that they want. And when we can build that relationship, we really will try to do so.
City Talk 105.9.
So we're here in one of the side offices, the quieter rooms of Operation Resolve, and I'm joined by two of the family liaison officers.
Okay, my name's Steve Lloyd.
And I'm Kelly Lewis.
So first of all, before we find out exactly what you do, how did you become involved in this?
Well, I'm a retired police officer from North Wales, and I applied to come on this investigation as a family liaison officer, which I think is a really, really important aspect of the investigation.
Yeah, I came here in May, initially on mutual aid from North Wales. I'm a current serving detective with North Wales, and I've been here since, applied to stay on the investigation, and I'm here seconded for a minimum of 2 years.
So you did both personally want to be involved in the investigation then?
I think that's a really important aspect of the investigation generally, that all the staff on the investigation want to be here. That's the serving police officers and the seconded police officers have applied to be here.
So how does your position work? What do you do in conjunction with the officers that are leading the criminal investigation? Obviously there's the IPCC upstairs to make sure you don't cross paths and that sort of thing. Like, talk us through a normal day, I suppose.
Well, I think the family liaison role within this investigation is slightly different to any other family liaison role. I mean, we've got 96 families, obviously, which we're trying to engage with and deal with on a personal basis, basically, as the investigation progresses. Clearly the families have their own reservations about dealing with, the police and this investigation and the IPCC, from their experiences in the past, really, for the last 24, 25 years, where, everybody really has been misled about what went on that day in April 1989.
Yeah, I mean, every day it is different. I think that's fair to say, in this investigation. But at the moment, we're currently involved with doing some work with a view to assisting the coronial team. So we're assisting, sort of finding out information about what happened to each of the individual people that died on that day. So that's currently what we're doing now in terms of the office. But if, for example, we were to be asked to meet with a family, that might happen, whether it be here or we'd go and meet them elsewhere, and that process would be answering those questions that the families have got about their particular individual loved one, working through those questions and trying to get those answers for them, but also meeting with them and explaining what we're doing, and just trying to build up a relationship. And also Steve mentioned there about level of trust, that's really significant for the families, and we want to make sure that we give all the families of all the 96 people the same level of service, and try and work with them, and try and get them the answers to the questions that they so desperately want answering.
We discussed earlier how important it is for transparency in the investigation with the families, so that they know it's been conducted as thoroughly and as properly and impartially as possible. And what are some of the questions, without breaking any sort of confidentiality, you can tell me about that they've
had? It's tricky. I mean, there's two sets of questions, really. There's like frequently asked questions, which concern perhaps the preparation for the match on the day, the match commanders and other bits and pieces. But there's also personal family questions that some families have, concern about the movement of their loved ones, after they sort of came onto the pitch, or and how they ended up in the mortuary and things like that, which are actually personal, specific to that family. And as Kelly explained, that's what we're trying to achieve, is trying to answer as many questions we can for the family. And these questions, let's be fair, they've been waiting to be answered for 24, 25 years, haven't they?
And some of them, I should imagine, you don't actually have the answers for yet.
Well, we don't, but we are working towards that. I think we have to be realistic that we won't be able to answer every question, because that's almost an impossibility. But all we can say is, as an investigation team, which has been led by Mr. Stoddard, that we'll do our very, very best to answer all the questions that the family ask.
Emotionally wise, I know it's a job and you're here for work, but you must have that emotional sort of connection with some members of the families as well, which I suppose at times can become quite personal.
Yeah, it can. I think, we're all human beings at the end of the day. We're here as family liaison officers and detectives, but ultimately, we are human, and the stories that they tell you and the journey that they've been on in the last 24 years, if that doesn't have an impact on you, then that would be very unusual. But, I think we've got a good team of family liaison officers. We make sure that we sit and debrief each other and we talk things through and we share the information that the families have told us. And that's really important, for our welfare, because we've got to be able to do the best possible job that we can for all of the families of the 96, and we are well supported here in terms of that, so it just helps you do your job a lot better.
Terry, how difficult or shocking is it for you to be deputy of an investigation into the police? I know it's not only the police, but into the police force and the cover-up that took place. These are obviously not close colleagues of yours, but the police force as a whole.
In terms of investigating the actions of police officers, it's something that we all do who are involved in investigation, and particularly those who've got a history in professional standards, which I do have because I used to be a head of professional standards in Manchester. At the end of the day, police officers are no better or worse than any other public servant, and it's important that we are considered in that way. So if a police officer acts inappropriately, unlawfully or criminally, they should be treated like any other member of the public. And it's really interesting in many ways that you have to have those conversations with every member of our team to make sure they understand we investigate any police officer like we investigate a member of any other service, a member of the club, a member of St John's Ambulance or a member of the crowd. You know, because they're a police officer, does not give them any right or exemption to criminal investigation. If anything, it means that we're more rigorous because they actually know what criminal investigation should be about. So for the police to investigate the police needs the safeguards in place that the Article 2 process has. So our actions are overseen by the Coroner's Inquest Team Council. Our actions are overseen by the legal teams representing the families. And that gives the safeguards to the families to understand that it's absolutely right for us to do the investigation, because actually when you look at the scope of an investigation of 96 deaths, the skills we need to bring to bear on that, the experience you need to bring to bear on that, actually only rests in the police service.
And how much of an opportunity is it to prove that the investigation can be conducted thoroughly and properly as well for you know the reputation of the police?
Well, it's key. You know, we started the conversation off talking about this in terms of what attracted me to this investigation. You know, the Hillsborough has been a stain on the police service's reputation for many years now, far too many years, and it's important that we actually remove those stains and show that the police service in 2013 has got that honesty, integrity and transparency to serve the community that we're meant to serve, have the confidence of that community. So it's a real opportunity for us all, and it's a real pleasure for us all to take forward this investigation, underestimating for one second the responsibility that goes with that. You know, this is a huge responsibility for John Stoddart leading the investigation, for ourselves to get the outcome for the families to the best possible rigour and the best depth of evidence we possibly can.
Still to come on City Talk 105.9, I'll be speaking to the leading officer on the investigation, Assistant Commissioner John Stoddart.
City Talk 105.9, behind the scenes of the Hillsborough investigation.
It's City Talk 105.9. We're still here at Renaissance House at the headquarters of the investigation into the Hillsborough disaster, and I'm here on the ground floor, which is Operation Resolve, and I'm joined now by head of that investigation, Assistant Commissioner John Stoddart. So first of all, how did you become involved in this? Because you retired from Durham in October last year, and then you were appointed onto this in December. I mean, did you opt to do this, or were you recruited? Or
it was basically yes. I retired in October, and I got a phone call a few weeks later from the Home Office saying that I was on a shortlist. Would I like to be considered? And it didn't take me very long to even think about it, really, because it's a massive honour to have been asked to do this, and a real responsibility for the kind of amount of expectation that's put onto my shoulders from the families and you know, Greater Merseyside. So it didn't take me long to say yes, and I was re-sworn in as a police officer at the end of December, curiously attached to the Metropolitan Police, but that's only because of technical details. But I am independent, and I think that's important that people understand that I'm independent of any police force. I have 165 investigators at the moment. I'm going out to get more on a short-term basis. So we'll be over 200 by the end of November with the following wind. And that's to help deal with the real kind of pressure of resolving a lot of the inquiries for the coroner's inquest.
Where do you begin on an investigation of this magnitude? I mean, there were tens of thousands of documents that the Hillsborough Independent Panel produced in their report in September of last year, and then you come on board, and where do you begin?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and a lot of people ask it. And basically, we scope everything. We review all the documentation that exists, including the Hillsborough Independent Panel report, which was an excellent piece of work. What we had to then look at was all the other associated documentation. There had been judicial inquiries, judicial reviews, interim reports, coronial inquiry, health and safety reviews, and so on. So we've basically been trawling all of that documentation, having to access some of it from archives, And then we put it all together and kind of computerize it, for want of a better expression, onto a bespoke system. And then we've linked that with the Independent Police Complaints Commission, and I'll tell listeners why a bit later. But the fact of the matter is, you start with what the existing level of knowledge is about the events on the 15th and the tragedy that unfolded. But it's far more than just the events of the day. We go right the way back to 1981 and before that, looking at what lessons have been learned from previous similar incidents at the Leppings Lane end at Hillsborough. What was the history behind the decision to award the semi-final there from the FA? What's the role of the club, the local authority, in terms of registration and licensing for the event, the Green Guide, and then the compliance with Green Guide, safety certification, engineering. So there's a massive amount of work that has to be done, but you base it on what is known in the first instance. And a lot is known, a lot of it is in the public domain, and it's then my job to make sense of that and to try and find new, compelling, new lines of inquiry, new and compelling evidence that can assist the coroner and assist any further criminal inquiry. My team are concentrating entirely now on the coroner's priorities to make sure that the deadline of the 31st of March next year is met. So we're working to his strategic priorities, but just to try and reassure people who are maybe listening that it isn't, that doesn't mean that the criminal investigation stops. It is part and parcel of a criminal inquiry. We are still conducting the same kind of level of intensity and inquiry and investigation through interviewing people, through research, through accessing documentation, through all the stuff that you would normally do, all the kind of usual investigative techniques and strategies. And then we give that to the coroner, and then we will take it back once the coroner's inquest is finished and complete the criminal inquiry.
So for the 31st of March next year, what is it you will need to provide to the coroner for the inquest?
We have to provide him with everything that he and his team, he's got a fairly large team who oversee my team. So they commission work to my team, and the pre-inquest hearing last Monday in the High Court, he made it clear that he was satisfied with what we were doing for him. And we are working at the moment on his first three strategic priorities, which are the stadium safety, the movements of the 96, and the response of the emergency services, including, importantly, the command and control of the day. So those are the three kind of key priorities that he wants us to concentrate on first, because that will be his first three parts of the inquest, following opening by the families and about their loved ones. So he's doing it in a kind of logical and sequential basis, and we help provide all that information in the form of statements, reports, interviews, so that they can then furnish that to the jury, so that they can then have a balanced and reasonable decision-making process.
And after the inquest is concluded, depending on whatever verdict is reached, how then would your investigation continue?
Well, we would then obviously pick up the file again, not physically, but simply, you know, we then carry on with after consultation with the Director of Public Prosecutions and the IPCC upstairs, and basically push on with our finishing off any things that need to be completed for prior to any criminal trial. And again, that, you know, that's a long way down the line, Lauren. We've got to make sure that we have decision making, and that's by the DPP rather than the police. So, you know, we've got a long way to go, but it's a sequential process. It's very logical. It's the coroner's process first, his strategic priorities being met by my team, them holding me to account, the IPCC overseeing the manslaughter part of the inquiry that involves the police. So they oversee and individually scrutinise that as well. And there is a lot of scrutiny of the inquiry, so it's much more open than in previous years.
How do you go about making sure that you don't end up doubling up on certain things? Because obviously your investigators are conducting interviews with witnesses and family members and so on, and the IPCC is working on a similar vein as well. How does that process work?
We recognised that almost from the first meeting, really, and we made sure that we had a commitment to working in a cooperative but independent way. So we are independent from each other. I know you've had a good look around. And in essence, they are secure units within one building, and the IPCC and ourselves, basically keep ourselves to ourselves, but we discuss those kind of key individuals who we may have to visit, or key families that we may have to visit together, where it would make absolute sense to do them jointly. And that's working very, very well.
Last week it emerged that more than 230-odd statements may have been altered. There's also allegations that footage, CCTV footage, may have been doctored. I mean, can you just explain to me the latest updates, and is there anything that we could be seeing emerge in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I mean, we've got to assess all of this, and allegations can be made quite easily, but we've got to be very careful that we just take a very measured and very balanced and very sensible, equitable approach to this. What we have found is that we've had a quite large number of interviews with serving and ex-police officers, retired police officers, and by and large, they want to cooperate. They want to tell everything that they can. Some of them got very little to add because they didn't see very much in the first place. But many of them want to speak to my investigators and to the IPCC investigators. And we've had letters of thanks from some of those officers saying how professionally they were dealt with. So we're trying to work our way through this logically and sensibly. And clearly, we will come to a point where we can come to some kind of key decisions about key individuals. We know that there have been very significant reductions of statements. The Hillsborough Independent Panel report highlighted that, and we've actually compared them right back to the original documentation. So we know that there are some very fundamental questions that key individuals have got to answer.
How difficult is it to conduct an investigation of this scale and size with so much media scrutiny? Like last week, we just mentioned the CCTV. Now that would be taken as gospel. You see the headlines now. Statements have been altered. Now CCTV has also been altered. That must be a lot of pressure, sort of having that focus on all the time. Is that quite difficult to contend with?
It is very difficult to contend with, because it does become the received wisdom that that statement was made as a suggestion, not as a statement of fact, but it became in the media that night, albeit everything else was pretty uncontroversial on that day last Monday. That came out as the banner headline in a lot of the red top papers. It is difficult, but we know that, and I knew that when I accepted this, Lauren, that this was going to be in the media spotlight. It is something that has been tremendously important for 24 and a half years, and it is always going to be a real seminal moment for policing, and a kind of seminal moment for football. You know, the whole kind of issue of all-seater stadiums came out of this absolute tragedy. So, it would have been daft to think, well, I'm going to go into this and I'm surprised at the media coverage. I was actually surprised in the first 6 months how low a media profile my team had, because we thought that we would be being interviewed by people like you on a regular basis. And really, it was only in the last 3 months that it's started picking up a little bit. But I'm used to it. I was a chief constable of a force, and I was an investigator before that, and, I've had this kind of pressure before. But nothing as big as this in terms of one investigation, certainly. But I've got a cracking team around me, of very good, very experienced, highly qualified investigators. I want to be able to finish this and look at everybody in the eye and say, we have done our absolute best, and I have done my absolute best to get to the bottom of everything, to get the truth and get the truth out there.
What powers do you have at your disposal to get all the documentation? Because I believe some officers aren't giving evidence, and there's some documents that still haven't been recovered and so on.
There are some documents that we're still keen to get a hold of. The coroner has made it very clear that he would like them to be served, and by and large, when that's said by Lord Justice Goldring, then things happen. I have got the full powers that I need for production orders if I require that, but so far we're not having any difficulty in getting hold of the documents that we need.
And I know you're leading the investigation, so you have to remain impartial. But, I think most families or listeners want to know how you personally, overseeing this, have been moved by what you've discovered and what you've been working on so far.
You can't help but fail as a human being, as a father, as a husband, as a football fan. You cannot help but get drawn into this and to feel an enormous emotional kind of empathy with those people who have gone through this dreadful, dreadful event, and what happened, some of the survivors, and for the families who have been left behind, this has been a long, long time in coming. My job is to be absolutely fair, to be impartial, and to investigate this absolutely thoroughly and to the best of my ability. But you cannot help but be, you know, you look around the Renaissance House, and everywhere you go you see photographs of the 96 deceased, and you know, overwhelmingly these were very young people who were in the prime of their life or hadn't even started entering the prime of their life. And you know, as a human being, it is extremely emotional to think like that. I try to you know, put it to the back of my mind when I'm thinking about work and when I'm working. You've got to be professional and you've got to, you know, just park it. But there are many times when I've met the families that you understand some of the distress and the emotion that they've gone through, and the respect that I have for them, for their dignity and the way they behave, has been, you know, reinforced over the last 9 months. They are, you know, really excellent people. My job is to make sure that they have the best investigation that they can possibly have, that everyone can have, that it is thorough and fair and balanced, and that I can look them in the eye at the end and say, I have done my absolute best for everyone.
That's Assistant Commissioner John Stoddart speaking to me from Renaissance House, the headquarters of Operation Resolve, the criminal investigation into the Hillsborough disaster. Later this week on City Talk 105.9, we will also be given an exclusive look at the offices of the police watchdog, the Independent Police Complaints Commission. Mick Coyle will be speaking to the deputy chair of the IPCC, Deborah Glass, and finding out the very latest in their separate investigation into the cover-up.
Behind the scenes of the Hillsborough investigation, City Talk 105.9.